Prison Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.cqut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, or on the second Thursday of every month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio or finding help searching for past programs, email prison@cqut.ca.
Consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a name. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
Oh, the law. The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
Good morning, and you are listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Candace.
My name is Noah.
And we're your hosts for today's show. Today we'll be hearing another piece from Inside correspondent Mutia Jumu Osagboro, who is currently incarcerated in Pennsylvania. In the piece, Moody talks about the challenges of re-entry, focusing specifically on romantic relationships with women. We also have an interview with a member of the support crew for the Cleveland Four, a group of young Occupy activists who were entrapped by the FBI, as well as the conclusion of the lecture by Ardith Wynot on queer prison abolition that we've been airing over the past few months. And as we often do, we'll start the show with some news items.
Bill C-56 was tabled in Parliament on June 19th. If passed, it will make important changes to the use of administrative segregation in federal prisons.
Under current solitary confinement policy, administrative segregation is used when there's no reasonable alternative to maintain the safety and security of the institution, staff, and inmates. This is different from disciplinary segregation, which is applied to prisoners who are found guilty by an independent chair of a disciplinary offense within the penitentiary. Under current policy, CSC must always release the prisoner from administrative segregation at the earliest appropriate time. 18 months after the new reform would come into effect, there would be a presumption that a prisoner must not remain in administrative segregation longer than 15 days. For the 18 months prior, the presumptive limit would be 21 days. Proposed reforms in the 2017 federal budget would further allow prisoners in administrative segregation out of their cells for 2 hours a day and allow them to daily showers and provide them with personal effects from their cell within 24 hours.
The proposed bill C-56 would also provide an independent external review of cases of prisoners kept in administrative segregation beyond the presumptive release date, and for those who have in the last calendar year been in administrative segregation at least 3 times or for 90 cumulative days. Bill C-56 further proposes to reinstate an offender's right to an oral hearing by the Parole Board of Canada following a suspension, termination, or revocation of parole or statutory release, and would indicate that offenders who commit an offense who meet the criteria for accelerated parole before March 28, 2011, are eligible for accelerated parole review. So in addition to the proposed legislation, the Correctional Service of Canada is amending its policy to prohibit administrative segregation for prisoners with mental health issues and those who are actively engaging in self-injury or are at elevated or imminent risk of suicide.
The time is presently 11:07 a.m., and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. This next piece comes to us from Inside correspondent Muti Ejamu Asagboro. Muti was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole as a child. In this piece, he responds to the Philadelphia Inquirer's recent articles about the reentry of people sentenced to life without parole as children. He speaks candidly about his situation and what it means to be sentenced to life without the possibility of parole as a child. He calls it death by incarceration, not life without the possibility of parole. Muti talks about the challenges he thinks he'll face on reentry. He focuses on his worries related to romantic relationships with women, given his priority in life of advocating for himself and others in his situation in the court system and beyond, and given his 36 years behind bars. He wonders out loud about communication skills in romantic relationships and respecting women's boundaries and desires. He's concerned about not being able to read body language and cultural signals that he missed by spending the majority of his life in prison.
Prison, reentry, my trepidation, women. Attention, calling angels that dare. Quote, sometimes I wonder if I know her, or if I really need to ask, or if I really need to ask. The woman in you is the worry in me. The woman in you, live from Mars, Ben Harper, and the innocent criminals, end quote. From last to first, rebirth and re-earth, to the alleged reentry writers. None of the so-called Philadelphia child advocates have informed us of your existence, so please read this carefully and publish for community enlightenment. In the context of a corrupt court system, Mars, this subject is as alien as anything you have ever experienced, and would otherwise be unfathomable if the unspoken is not plainly spoken. The clear word must be articulated. The Dogon nation of West Africa call it Sodai, meaning the clear word. It is the highest statement of consciousness, the peak of one's humanity comprehended. It's when the essence of a word becomes crystal clear in a relationship to an event, people, or sentient beings. The Lakota nation have a similar concept of elevated consciousness in their culture as well. While the above Ben Harper's lyrics allows you to understand this Mars experience in the mind and heart, it is the notoriously talented Innocent Criminals band that allows you to understand it sonically at the level of spirit, a transcending, pulsating groove that makes skin and bones comprehend it, giving your very skin an explanation that brings into harmony and understanding of all the other elements of your being. A groove that makes spirit a bridge that immediately closes the distance between isolation and intimacy and fires the quest for men to bond with women naturally and sustain it with reflections on how to get closer and go deeper in understanding. Does this have anything to do with my reentry and Philadelphia's court system? Oh, you didn't think this was a philosophical fire drill, did you? There is the legal and then there's the psychological. Legally, my reentry is all about ending my child death by incarceration, euphemistically termed life without parole.
Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Rockview.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
Euphemistically termed life without parole by the state of Pennsylvania.
No third-party calls are allowed.
Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania, because it leads the world in dishing out to children this draconian conviction and sentence. At worst, I'll be resentenced and set free 2 weeks or so thereafter. At best, I'll be exonerated of all charges and set free immediately. in the true sense of the word, from the courtroom. For examples of this type of vindication, I have listed in order the names of the exonerees, the location of the case, the age of arrest, the number of years served, and the crimes charged. Google the following cases. Devante Stanford, Detroit, age 14, served 8 years, quadruple contract killing. Ivan Serrano, Philadelphia, 17, homicide robbery of a pedestrian. Stephen Crawford, Harrisburg, PA, 15, homicide of a child neighbor. Jeffrey Deskovich, Westchester County, New York, 16, rape murder of a female child schoolmate. Santee Tribune, Washington, D.A., 17, homicide. Ryan Ferguson, Jefferson City, Missouri, 16, homicide robbery of a purported wealthy journalist. Kwame Adjumu, Cleveland, 1729.
This is from Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Rockview.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
Cleveland, 1729, homicide robbery. Timothy Cole, Dallas, Texas, 1613. Rape murder, died in prison but posthumously vindicated. Daniel Taylor, Chicago, 1720, double homicide robbery of an alleged drug dealer and prostitute. Roshan S. Hardgrave, 1723, Brooklyn, New York, homicide of an off-duty prison guard. There are many other exonerees, but these are just enough to whet your appetite against injustice all over America. All the above exonerees were children. Most of them were sentenced to death by incarceration. Nationwide, out of all the thousands of them vindicated, 13% were children. Of that number, almost 80% were black and brown youth. The first crime, which is the worst crime, committed against these children is that the court system and all of its agents did not see them as children. The entire court entity literally robbed them of their childhood by not even acknowledging that they were, in fact, first and foremost, children. When you read all of their stories, you will notice that all of the writers refused to call them children, when they would have done so if these disgraceful numbers were white faces, victims of the court by illegal conviction. As Philadelphia playwright Sister Coker so profoundly reminds us, the first part of this social downward spiral is in us not calling our children children, but rather every euphemism in the book to remove and avoid the protective hedge of international law that is triggered by the title child, which also commands multiple moral, national legal obligations on all the adults involved within and without the court system. Euphemisms like minor, adolescent, kid, teen, youth. All these terms are commonly used in daily speech, but most don't know that their true legal and etymological meanings are degrading and designed to circumvent the sympathy and sensitivity that is innate in matters involved with children. The most pernicious of these misnomers is the word juvenile. For a broader understanding of this overall concept of attacking children through legalese, please read The Essence of Innocence, The Consequences of Dehumanizing Black Children by Dr. Philip Akib Joff and Promoting Racial Literacy in School by Professor Howard Stevenson. This is the reason for this serial series. Nevertheless, I realize that if you're not a legal buff, my legal wranglings of being prosecuted as a child who is actually innocent, with the evidence to prove it, may not interest you, but my psychological state may. As such, in terms of you assisting in whatever way possible to help me make a successful psychological transition to remedy, if at all possible, the sole trepidation I have about my return to the community, women, sending out a plea from a place where some angels dare not visit. Try to put yourself in my state boots. For me, it's like an involuntary steeplechase, where in order to efficiently navigate the possibility of at least having a smidgen of enjoyment in which I'm about to embark upon with my reentry, I must look past the inherent evil of my legal conviction and all that that entails, meaning focuses on my family and not so much on Philadelphia's systemic dirty courts, where prosecutors and judges are identical twins and so-called defense attorneys, closet prosecutors, are the third wheel no one wants because you learn quickly that they are all part of the rig. The mental aerobatics acrobatics required is a mashup of hurdle and hunting for the Holy Grail, knowing that they both exist, but one is seen and the other is unseen. The visible drives me to the goal of the unseen, while I am walking over a trapeze without a safety net. The citizenry on the sideline who have not experienced even a single day within the cogs of the court system see this reality as terrifying, so they dismiss it. My high wiring existence is not humanly possible. Yet, I do it every morning when I rise, buoyed by Sweet Honey in the Rock, continuing the fight for freedom by ending this injustice. For the Jane and John Q public that think one day cannot radically open their eyes to what is going on in the so-called justice system, need only revisit the life and writings of David Henry Thoreau. After Thoreau spent one night in a Concord, Massachusetts jail, the wool was pulled off his eyes completely. Only after one night in jail, just one. His essay, Civil Disobedience, speaks to this lens defogging consciousness. If you want to help me in a way that's actually meaningful to psychologically prepare for my return to the community, then enlighten me on what 2017 women want. For more than 3.5 decades, this has been the bane of my existence. Thus, if my educational outreach is to be in any way relevant, I need you, dear listener, to help me with this, my only hurdle. One of the several things that was said to me that is actually useful when I met with the chairman of the Pennsylvania Probation and Parole Board was from one of his deputies and fellow board member. In his truthful acknowledgement of my reentry situation, he was as accurate as could be said. Quote, a child came to prison, but now a man is returning home. Very few people in the Pennsylvania DOC are that truthful and honest in such a contentious matter. In spite of this vote of confidence, I can ill afford to be presumptuous when dealing with a court system that is more concerned with saving face than doing the right thing. The operative words are child and man. Quite honestly, though, the man, moi, does not know what 2017 women are searching for. Spirituality? Intellectualism? Is it all about salary? Does money suddenly make a man sensible? Said another way, is the standard of acceptance monetary? Does dollars make sense of any man? Are they searching for emotional reciprocity, emotional accessibility, emotional availability, unbridled physicality? The former, all things emotional, expressed through the musical prism of the insightful Alanis Morissette, and the latter by the even more insightful and vividly expressive Elle Varner, also depicted cinematically in films like 50 Shades of Grey. Are their songs just songs, or are their songs indicative and reflective of women who are looking for this, what they are looking for in this so-called postmodern age? Is the popular embrace of certain types of cinema an example of women who are just bored and unfulfilled, or just those who are being vicariously stimulated by a deep-seated longing for male communication that will nurture connectedness that seeks answers that remove the need to engage in the impossible mind read in order to build an intimate relationship that goes beyond the predictable or social proverbial? Is it all of the above? None of the above? If it's some of the above, which some is healthy for engagement and which for exclusion? How do I, without reserve, probe each cavity well beyond the depths of superficiality to discover which is which, without encroaching on some tacit, even imaginary, but never acknowledged line of 2017 social etiquette? Will my constant craving to always delve deeply, explore thoroughly, reciprocate incessantly, create discomfort for the 2017 woman? These are the things that give me angst, excitement, but also dread. These issues cannot merely be explained away by declaring that this is about my fearing the unknown, because I embrace the unknown as the yet-to-be-discovered other possibilities. Unlike most, I celebrate the unknown because it is the new more better, whether in the form of a life lesson that brings clarity or reverie from the all-too-often-overlooked complexities in the simple act of breathing, that is, being conscious of taking a breath for the sake of breathing and not because of some pending danger, knowing full well that in spite of all the bullets, blades, and pepper sprays deployed against my soul, not only have I prevailed, but I have transcended the court's systemic evil. Perpetual miracle of being alive and present in a life with each heartbeat, at times being intoxicated by the rhythm of its percussion. Simply stated, I do not want to impose on anyone's space, time, or life. I want to bring, by synthesis, laughter, fun, joy, excitement, intrigue, and unlimited possibilities to a woman's life. Nor do I, by expressing a simple hello, want to trigger the societal abnormal norm, the humdrum.
You have 1 minute left.
Sadness, anxiety, apprehension, redundancy, and circumspection. Refusal to succeed, mislabeled as immovable limitations, that slowly, even imperceptibly, diminish the sacred self. Where failure to dare is refusal to live. Is she ready for political vocation? Where my staunch human rights child advocacy for public education and rights vindication within the courts comes first. How can I be mindful about not crossing an unedged line? More importantly, one that I don't even know exists. One woman's modesty is another woman's unwanted suppression of her natural introduction to a no-holds-barred coming attraction, while another woman's need for constant social intercourse is deemed aggressive and off-putting to the next. How do I discern the prude from the playmate, or all the possible shades in between? The uninhibited from the emotionally constipated. Is it dialogue or dress? If it's communication, is it verbal or nonverbal? In her mind, does the dress make the woman look good, or does the woman make the dress look good? Or is it some unexpected or unexpressed specific 2017 signal that I'm absolutely ignorant about because of 36 years of inhumane and unlawful imprisonment? Is Mother Nature still the navigator? Does the scent of readiness still lie true for women? Or has it been replaced by robotic disengagement of her electronic device? That is to say, when she shuts off her smartphone, she's tired, thus ready for something else, which could, but not necessarily include, the company of a man. Not any man, but specifically me, the non-electronic junkie. But one that is likewise addicted to live, human face-to-face dialogue, the prolific listener. My meditation is that I am not too candid about my psychological state and the buzzing trepidation it feeds. My personal and empirical courtroom experience, particularly one under the unacknowledged Child Death by Incarceration Act, has been, more often than not, when one expresses an interest to help, all of a sudden, it's either superficial or in matters not germane to one's pressing concerns, especially regarding mental health and freedom. Health and freedom. Success demands that they be a tandem linked at the hip. Thus, if you reach out to children, girls and boys, in my situation, who have now become women and men, you must be mindful that we have been robbed of our childhoods physically, psychologically, economically, intellectually, politically, and socially. So bring these resources to the operating table to help repair and restore, if at all possible, all that has been damaged and stolen. Footnote. This series, this serial series, is necessary because it is clear.
Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Rockview.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
This serial series is necessary because it is clear that most of the people speaking and writing about our reentry don't know, and they intentionally keep talking to people who don't know, or know very well but won't say because it will interfere with their money and prestige opportunities. In the coming months, I will name names and connect the dots to the roadblockers and misdirectors in our city, lest we forget the Philadelphia Negro, W.E.B. Du Bois' Syrian account of white supremacy's devastation of black people, especially children, in Philadelphia, makes us realize that contemporary brotherly loathing in our city is the poisonous fruit of the court's historical tree. Our desire is to educate not just the Delaware Valley, but the entire Pennsylvania and both national and international communities about what is really going on behind the curtain in Oz, or in this case, Mars. And yes, Houston, we definitely have a problem. In the bowels of the Terror Dome, this is Muti Ajimu Oseboru, a child from America's other death row. I'm out.
That was Inside correspondent Muti Ajemu Asaigboro. Muti is an advocate for people like him who were sentenced to death by incarceration as children. This piece was a response to a series of articles that ran in the Philadelphia Inquirer about the reentry of so-called child lifers. The articles didn't quote any people sentenced to life without parole as children.
And next here on the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, we are going to hear from Amanda. Amanda is part of the support crew for the Cleveland Four, a group of young Occupy activists who are entrapped by the FBI in a plot to blow up a bridge and prosecuted as terrorists. They are all serving about a decade in prison to be followed by a lifetime of probation. Oops. Can you start off by introducing yourself? Who are you, and what is your relationship to the Brendan Baxter and Cleveland Four case?
Yeah, I'm Amanda, and I've been helping with support work for the Cleveland Four for the last about a year. And specifically with Brandon, I've been doing some legal work with him, and so I've also developed a more personal relationship with him through that.
And can you tell us a bit about the Cleveland Four? Who are they?
The Cleveland Four it's Brandon Baxter, Connor Stevens, Doug Wright, and Josh Stafford, who also goes by Skelly. And they were a group of Occupy activists in Cleveland who were entrapped in an FBI-created plot to blow up a bridge. And they were arrested for that, and they are each serving about 10 years in prison to be followed by being on a lifetime probation after, because there was a terrorist enhancement on their case.
Amanda, can you tell us a little bit about, well, tell us more about the entrapment scenario. So take us back in time a few years to when they were organizing. My understanding is that they were organizers with Occupy Cleveland. Can you tell us a little bit about Occupy Cleveland to begin with?
So I think that in telling their story, it makes, I guess, more sense to talk about the Occupy movement as a whole in the U.S. and what the relationship with that was to the U.S. government. There have been documents that were obtained through Freedom of Information Act requests that show that even before the first Occupy encampment has actually been set up, when it was just still an idea that was being talked about, that the government was already starting to treat it as a terrorist threat. And so that kind of sets the stage for how the government treats social movements that they are worried about disrupting the status quo. And so in Cleveland, that was where one of these encampments was at. And this group of people who were referring to the Cleveland Four were people who were part of that camp, you know, doing things like sharing food, like food not bombs type stuff, talking about doing protests. They were protesting foreclosures on homes and trying to also, you know, network with other people in the area to be able to expand the protesting that they were doing. And they were also, you know, a group of people that identified as anarchist, and so that was, like in many Occupy camps, there were some divisions between people who identified as anarchist versus people who were maybe more liberal identifying, which unfortunately is a common thing that we see in social movements, where a lot of times people with more liberal agendas kind of push away people who are anarchist, not realizing the dangers that such divisions bring. So anyway, they were a group of people that were involved in that, and because the government had this interest in, you know, as I said, they were treating it as a so-called, like, terrorist threat before Occupy was even actually happening. And so the government then had an interest in making sure that, you know, they were able to follow through and showing what a, you know, extremist threat this was. And so there was a paid FBI informant who spent literally months talking with these people, like coercing them in a variety of ways, everything from giving them drugs and alcohol to giving them employment to giving them money, keeping them very isolated from other people, keeping them sleep deprived, having conversations with them that, you know, weren't even recorded for the FBI. And so a lot of very sketchy stuff going on. And then through this time, he is he's the informant, being paid by the FBI, and also working with an FBI handler to craft this plot to blow up a bridge. And, you know, kept trying to manipulate them into doing this, even though they tried many times to say, like, no, that's not what we want to do. We just want to do other kinds of protests and civil disobedience type things. He kept pushing, and the FBI ultimately supplied fake explosives, and this informant drove them to the bridge that, you know, he was supposedly getting them to try to blow up. And so we can see, like, just so many examples of then how the whole story unfolded, that it was very much an FBI-created plot that these people were manipulated into participating in. And then on the end of that, they are arrested, prosecuted as terrorists, and then the FBI was able to do all their press releases, do a lot of media about how Occupy extremists or terrorist-type narrative.
Yeah, this is also happening at a time, like it was the same year as like the NATO 3. It was the height of the student strike movement here in Quebec, which saw unprecedented repression. I don't know if you want to speak more about some of the events, the political events that were taking place in 2012 that might have further contextualized the severe repression in this particular case.
I think that, at least, like, speaking to, like, in the U.S. and how government policies have taken shape, a lot of it has to do with the post-September 11th context in which we're living. That continues to be a point at which the government, in developing things like the Patriot Act after that, and then this increased emphasis on, you know, capturing the so-called terrorists, paved the way for the government to use that against social movements or anyone that they want to be able to, you know, quickly create a villain out of when it suits government interest. And, you know, we can look at what happened to the Cleveland Four as this kind of a blueprint of, there were a group of vulnerable young men, an FBI informant went in and manipulated them, there's a, you know, so-called terrorist plot, and then the government gets to do press releases about, you know, ending the threat, even though they created it in the first place. And it's something that we've unfortunately also seen play out against young Muslim men. And we can see, you know, both in the social movement context as well as against the Muslim community, how it all kind of wraps up into this pattern of that the government has taken on this power in the post-9/11 era of using that word terrorism to be able to manipulate public fear and then be able to carry out whatever, you know, COINTELPRO type tactics and, you know, surveillance and whatever they want to do, because in the public's eye, as long as they do it under this guise of counterterrorism tactics, they get they continue to see public support for that, as well as a lot of government funding going into it. So it's unfortunately become this, you know, way in which the government has this kind of self-profiting way of continuing to use prosecutions like this to unfortunately pull people into the legal system in ways that they shouldn't be, and the government gets the benefit of what they're doing to people.
And so Brandon Baxter and the other members of the Cleveland Four are paying the price. They're in prison right now. They're serving, you said, 10 years?
Each of them is serving about a decade, give or take a year or two for each of them.
And I know that you regularly visit some of them in prison, and I'm just wondering if you can share with us maybe, like, how they're doing.
Yeah, so Brandon is the only one that I'm, like, personally regularly in touch with. He transferred to FCI Pekin in Pekin, Illinois, in April. So he has been kind of in the process still of settling in there. Whenever people transfer between prisons, there's an adjustment period because, you know, all their routines and, you know, everything they've established in one place gets all shaken up and they have to adjust to being somewhere else. So he's been kind of in that process dealing with trying to figure out, you know, what classes he wants to do, starting to work there. He enjoys painting, so he's been starting to do that again, and just trying to figure out how he wants to spend the rest of his time. He has about 3 years left in prison, and getting to the point where, you know, so that's now a bit over halfway for him, and so getting to the point where he's, you know, thinking about what he wants to do when he gets out, while also still trying to balance that with thinking about his present reality is still prison every day and how to deal with that and to make the most of his time that he can. I know he's talked before about not wanting to feel like this time is just completely taken from him, and trying to make it what he can for himself as he's waiting to get out. And the others, Connor, Doug, and Josh, are in other federal prisons in the U.S., and Josh also recently had to deal with a transfer. They've all generally had fairly rough times in prison, being in, like, medium and high-security facilities, spending periods of time in the SHU, kind of what was referred to for solitary confinement. And so just kind of remembering, like, that, you know, they all went in there at pretty young ages, after dealing with these months of being heavily manipulated by someone, as they were, you know, trying to get their footing in social movements, and then having that terrorism enhancement following them through the prison system. So just all have at least a couple years left and just need continued support while they're in there, and then to remember that even when they get out of prison, that they're looking at lifetime supervised release. And so they're going to need support in dealing with what that means for them as they get out, as they continue to face government monitoring and probation conditions.
How can folks support Brandon Baxter and the Cleveland Four?
So there is a support website. It's clevelandforsolidarity.org. There's also a Facebook page and a Twitter page that updates are regularly posted on. And on the support site, you can also see each of their addresses. So you can see that for writing them letters, sending cards and photos. They also each have a book wish list up there, because books are a great way for them to be able to spend their time. And there's also information about making donations. Because unfortunately it is expensive for people when they're in prison. They have to pay for everything, making phone calls, being able to have stamps to write letters, sending emails, being able to buy personal care products or extra food. And it's all, you know, marked up in price because the prisoner is trying to profit off people in that way as well. So for anyone who is able to make a donation, that's really helpful to them in being able to take care of themselves as well as to keep in touch with loved ones.
And Amanda, kind of a personal question. As someone who offers support to someone in jail, do you have maybe some words of wisdom or advice to offer to other people who are supporting loved ones in jail?
Yeah. I've never been asked this before. I would, at least not in this form. I guess my advice would be to be there for people. Like, unfortunately, something I've noticed in doing this work is that a lot of times when cases are new, people get a lot of support, and then over the years, a lot of that support disappears. And so that, you know, is something that happens in the broader political movement realm, which it's good to see. I feel like recently there's been more conversation around that and, like, the continued need for support for prisoners as they move further into their sentences. But even on that, like, more personal level, like, it can be heartbreaking at times to, like, be there supporting people through everything that they go through. in prison, but it's so important that we are there and that, you know, we're there with people through the, you know, slightly easier times as well as in the hard times, and to not let the prison system be what pulls us away from people, and to keep making sure that people know that we care about them and that we'll be there for them and that we'll be there for them, like, through their time in prison and even after, and that they can count on us.
Thank you so much, Amanda, for your time. Do you have any final thoughts or comments you'd like to share with our listeners, or any further updates, anything that we missed that you really wanted to share?
Yeah, I guess I would just, for people who are maybe newer to the idea of supporting prisoners, or maybe newer to the idea of, you know, what are all the vast numbers of problems with the prison industrial complex, I encourage people to just write a letter, whether it's to one of the Cleveland Four or to another political prisoner or to someone else that you're connected to. Write people a letter. It can mean the world to someone to hear from someone, to get mail for that day, and to feel connected through the walls of prison. And it's, I think, the best way to really start connecting with people and learning more about the prison system from the people who are actually experiencing it, because, you know, when we're talking about, you know, everything that we're up against in trying to support prisoners and keep our social justice movement strong and push back against the prison system, like, those personal bonds are what are so important in being able to have the strength to do that and remembering the importance of doing it. So, yeah, I would just say write a letter.
That was Amanda, who does support work for the Cleveland Four, a group of young Occupy activists who were entrapped by the FBI and are each serving about a decade in prison. For more information about their case, visit clevelandforsolidarity.org. You are still listening to CQUT 90.3 FM. Next, we are going to hear from Wanda Jackson with Riot in Cell Block Number 9.
On July 2nd, 1953, I was serving time in Tehachapi. 4 o'clock in the morning, I was sleeping in my cell. I heard a whistle blow, and I heard somebody yell, "There's a riot going on. There's a riot going on. There's a riot going on." Up in cell block number 9. The trouble all started up in cell block number 4. Spread like fire across the prison floor. Warden came in with a big Tommy gun. Bang, bang, bang. Trying to stop my fun, but there's a riot going on. There's a riot going on. There's a riot going on. Up in cell block number 9. With your hands up in the air, you don't stop this riot, you all gonna get the chair. Two gun Matilda said it's too late to quit. Pass the dynamite, Molly, 'cause man, this is lit. There's a riot going on. There's a riot going on. There's a riot going on. Up in cell block number 9. State militia to help them win the fight. Drove up to the prison in the middle of the night. Each and every trooper, he looked so tall and fine. All the chicks went crazy up in cell block number 9. Now there's a riot going on. There's a riot going on. There's a riot going on. Up in cell block number 9.
And that was Wanda Jackson with Riot in Cell Block Number 9 here on the Prison Radio Show. We will end our show today with the conclusion of the lecture by Ardith Wynot on queer prison abolition. We aired the earlier parts of this lecture on previous episodes of the Prison Radio Show. Ardith Wynot is a sociology professor at Mount Allison University and teaches a poetry and performance program at Dorchester Penitentiary in Mi'kmaq Territory in so-called New Brunswick. She gave several public lectures around the Maritimes in early spring about carceral state violence in queer, trans, and two-spirit lives. This is a brief excerpt of the talk she delivered at Dalhousie University in Halifax.
So let's talk a little bit about solitary confinement, or ADSEG, administrative segregation. So within jurisdictions where trans inmates are not housed in facilities that correspond to their gender, they're housed in segregation for their own protection. So this is where the state quite literally forces us back into another kind of closet. Where policies and institutions fail to respond to the vulnerabilities and needs of queer and trans people, solitary confinement becomes the only course of action to prevent harassment and assault by other inmates and staff. But this is in reality, of course, an act of punishment. Extended periods in segregation, and when you get sent to solitary confinement for your own protection, it's generally referred to as administrative segregation. So in the Correctional Services of Canada handbook, which is about this thick, you can go to solitary confinement for two reasons. One is punitive, and one is if you're on suicide watch or if it's for your own protection. Extended periods in solitary confinement take an immense psychological toll on inmates. It increases suicidality and self-harm behaviors. It creates extended periods of suffering, isolation, and loneliness. It prevents engagement in programs such as AA, emotional processing groups. It prevents you from seeing a counselor. Now, many of the examples I've raised so far apply the most clearly to trans women, or in many cases, gay men, who are housed in facilities that perpetuate toxic masculinity, such as a men's prison. But let's go back to the three women I spoke about earlier, three queer women in my class. Let's imagine for a second that the one I suspect to be somewhere on the trans spectrum, who sometimes identifies as a woman and sometimes on a particular day identifies as a bro, just imagine that they receive support pre-incarceration for hormone therapy. That's something that they wanted to do. So let's imagine that they appear much more masculine than they would otherwise. It's very likely in this situation that they would have been placed in segregation or at least separated from other women on the unit to prevent sexual relationships. And this is speculation on my part, but it's speculation that's confirmed by discussions with correctional officers. So we're going to take it as a highly likely outcome. So in this sense, we can see again how prisons serve to reproduce the gender binary and punish gender nonconformity. We can also see how ADSEG increases risk for suicide, self-harm, and prevents any type of rehabilitation. So we're going to talk a little bit more about suicide and then move on, I promise. We know that death by suicide and we know that self-harm are the consequences of homophobia and transphobia inside our prisons and in our communities. And once again, we want to see those two things as connected. Research in Ontario has shown that LGBTQ youth in Canada are 14 times more likely to attempt suicide or have a substance abuse problem. We know that queer and trans youth have roughly double the risk for PTSD than their heterosexual and cisgendered peers. And some of the more nuanced research has shown that these mental health problems, especially in trans folks, are the direct result of stigma and discrimination. So trans youth who have access to transition surgery, where that's what they want, that's what they desire, and those who are able to change their provincial identification have much lower rates of suicide. Thus, correctional policies that refuse to adopt and allow for medically necessary procedures and other forms of trans support are in many ways signing death certificates for those inmates. Let's consider a recent and very difficult case in Georgia, in the United States, where trans inmate Ashley Diamond was refused hormone therapy and gender reassignment surgery, even though she'd been on hormone therapy for 17 years prior to her incarceration. She was sexually assaulted 8 times while being placed in a men's facility, and she attempted to castrate herself and later attempted suicide. And I say this not to shock you, but simply to drive the point home that changing policies in how our prisons work is a life or death issue. Although there are not many cases like Ashley's in Canada, we must be steadfast and brave in pushing for a queer approach to justice that acknowledges the trauma of homophobic and transphobic violence that lands queer people in prison in the first place. Hurts people, hurts people. Simple to say, much more difficult to apply to a justice system that is structured according to moral dichotomies that erase the complexity of our experiences with violence, power, and harm. And there also remain significant challenges to advocating for trans inmates, and this is something that I've struggled with a lot in my academic work. So there was a very recent case just a couple of weeks ago in New Brunswick, where we were notified by a correctional officer who is an ally that a trans woman was being incarcerated in a provincial facility. And they were worried about their safety and wanted to draw some attention to it. We mobilized, we got media attention, journalists got Howard Sapers, the correctional investigator, on the phone, and we were ready to run a story when we found out that the actual charge in her case was that of first-degree murder. And it was a fairly high-profile case, which left us feeling that this was not the test case for trans rights in prisons in New Brunswick, because murder cases bring out the most punitive and retributive impulses in the general public. So we thought it would actually harm our cause and also potentially harm this offender's case, because they hadn't even went to trial yet and the public didn't know they were trans. But despite challenges for advocacy and despite the somewhat troubling and disturbing situation of trans and homophobic violence in Canadian jails, I think that there are some concrete ways in which we can move towards queer prison justice. And I think the first one is that our federally appointed correctional investigator, Howard Sapers, or whoever replaces him in the future, must immediately engage the work of queer and trans advocacy organizations to include the mention of queer and trans people as minorities that are overrepresented in the prison system, and this must be noted in all official reports. Because federal and provincial jails make it so difficult for faculty researchers to do the type of research we need on sexual assault and queer experience in jail, the Ombudsman's Office must make it their mandate to do so. We need data to support a movement for prison justice. We must also recognize that the continued silence of the Ombudsman's Office to include data on sexual minorities in prison is an expression of homophobia. A sincere commitment to collecting more and better data on queer and trans prison experiences will help us build the critical movements that we need to tackle the prison industrial complex and the ways in which it's entangled in bigger systems of gendered oppression. Two, we have poor Howard a break. I would like to call upon the Elizabeth Fry Society and the John Howard Society to begin a dialogue on how to better advocate for gender non-conforming inmates. When our prison advocacy organizations and not-for-profit organizations are structured according to the gender binary, they're failing to protect queer people, which is ultimately unjust. There has been a troubling trend of transphobia in women's advocacy groups, some of whom are fighting against having trans women housed in women's facilities. I have read editorials from the UK, the US, and Canada that argue that trans women are just men in women's clothing, or one editorial that wrote wolves in sheep's clothing, trying to get into women's jails to take advantage of and sexually assault female offenders. This is deeply disturbing. It's deeply transphobic, and it needs to be called out and no longer tolerated in feminist advocacy circles. I would also like to call upon the Elizabeth Fry Societies across Canada to engage trans advocacy groups in learning about and posting education systems on the risks that trans women of color face for sexual violence, especially within prisons. Leadership in these prominent feminist organizations and in organizations like John Howard must denounce transphobia and accept that trans women are women, trans men are men. Three, this is the one that's closest to my heart. I would like to see a move towards trauma-informed correctional practice. Raise your hand if you know what trauma-informed practice means. Yeah, the most important thing about trauma-informed practice, and as it would apply in a correctional setting, is that it reframes the notion of risk and the notion of security. So you would no longer be allowed to see an offender as posing a risk to the general population. You would see the risk as coming from you and impacting them in a way that makes them vulnerable. So it completely reshapes the way in which we think about vulnerability in our practice, and it would make correctional officers and prison staff more attentive to their power in their work with inmates. Now, this is easier said than done. Our prisons are a mess, especially after the last two federal governments we've had, but I think it's something we can definitely move towards. And in many cases, so secure mental health facilities often function, they're architecturally and in policy the same as prisons in the way that they work, the way that they negotiate risk. Instead of solitary confinement, they call it TQ or therapeutic quiet, but there are essentially solitary confinement units in mental health wards. Now, cases like the Rehtaeh Parsons case, for example, where there was a lot of public outcry over the ways in which she was forcibly strip searched after a suicide attempt by male orderlies, and this is something her family protested against. In response, the IWK Health Center has implicated, or they've started a process of moving towards trauma-informed practice with their staff. And in other hospitals across the country, where this has been successful, they no longer need to use TQ. They have different strategies and different ways of working with folks living on the unit that doesn't involve locking them up in a room with a camera on them and having them in social isolation. So we can assume that if we can do it correctly in hospitals, use solitary confinement, it may work in maximum security units. Four, I think we need a change in federal correctional policy so that administrative segregation is no longer the go-to solution for the protection of an inmate. And I think trauma-informed practice will help us. I think it will help us get to a point where protecting each other doesn't mean locking us in our room and putting us on a really terrible timeout. Five, all provinces should follow Ontario's lead in allowing trans inmates to choose the facility they feel most comfortable in. Once again, this will really reduce the use of solitary confinement if the provincial policies change and offenders are given some say over where they're incarcerated. Six, this is, I think, is one of the most important ones. We need to improve gender and sexuality education at all levels of society and invest in shelters, social services, mental health and addictions exclusively for queer and trans youth and adults. And that is functioning at the level where we will be preventing incarceration. And seven, I urge all of us to take up queer positions of analysis in our personal and professional lives and make a mess of dichotomous concepts that make tidy and simple moral judgments out of what is ultimately a very messy landscape of social power, violence, and harm. If we can dismantle the way the gender binary structures our consciousness, I think that we can dismantle systems of oppression that force us into closets and segregation units. A queer approach to justice could transform our system into one that puts healing and liberation at the center of a collective pursuit of a better world.
Thank you. That was Artist Why Not here on the Prison Radio Show, speaking at Dalhousie School of Law.